You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 8th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How is everyone doing this week?
Good, I'm back.
Hanging in there.
Yep, we're good. Back. Kara back, is in Africa.
Right.
She's on safari right now, so I would imagine.
Last week, I took a cruise.
Yeah, how was that?
Oh, yeah, Jay.
First one of my life. You know, it was like a bucket list type of thing. You know, it's the first real vacation that we've actually had since we got married 7 years ago, and it's the first vacation that we really have had without the kids. So it was like, it was awesome just to, you know, get my head out of the daily grind like that. But I got to tell you, you know, after reviewing this particular cruise line, I understand that they're not all the same, but there was quite a few things that I did not like about going on a cruise. And one of them really was how much they nickel and dime you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like you buy the drink package, but then it doesn't include, oh, I don't know, coffee. You know, like you can't get good coffee.
Bob's out.
You know, yeah. They have like the swill coffee that they make that is available, but it's not, you know, you can't go to, there was a Starbucks on board and I could, you know, it was $8 for a freaking coffee. You know, I'm like, I wanted to die.
It was the only Starbucks for 1,000 miles around.
So there is a little bit of a scam, in my opinion, that I wanted to report to our listeners about this. Because, you know, they don't make you aware of what it's really going to be like when you go on the cruise. They don't tell you, oh, by the way, you know, like we're gonna hit you up for every little doodad. You know, like if you want your room turned down, which I never cared about. And if you don't know what that is, it means that like someone will come in before bedtime and they'll pull your sheets back and put a chocolate on your bed and maybe give you some fresh towels or whatever. You know, every hotel is different. And essentially a cruise ship is a floating hotel. So they charge you for that. That's not a courtesy. That's, you know, that comes at a price. And there was a ton of things like that that typically you would get for free that came at a price on this cruise line. The other weird thing, I had no idea that there was that this even ever happened in any legitimate hotel, but they were very weird about the towels. And I hate to say something like this because it's so weird to me. Like I when my wife and I realized that every time we wanted to grab a couple of extra towels, you know, there's swimming pools on the boat. You're taking a couple of showers easily from sweating and from going into the, you know, the pools and all that stuff. But like one time it really got actually awkward. It was like one of the people that is in charge of the floor, you know, for housekeeping. And the guy was like, well, wait, you know, your room was made. How do you know you don't have fresh towels in your room? And I said, well, I know that I don't because I just use them and I'm going to go to the pool and I'd like to take another shower and I want fresh towels. Okay. You know, and the guy was like, yeah, but you know, you had fresh towels this morning. And I'm saying to myself,
it's a quota.
I've never had a hotel fight with me over towels.
Yeah, wow. They fought with you over towels. It was very weird.
Yeah.
And then I just got to the point where every time I walked by one of the wagons that the housekeeping uses for the restock wagons, you know, the towels,
yeah,
whatever you call those things, I'd grab an armful of towels, little ones, big ones. I was just doing it out of spite at that point because I'm like,
oh my God,
I'm paying a lot of money and I want water absorption to a max in my room. How about that?
You think is it a Norwegian thing? Is it a ship thing? Is it like towel, like laundering
like,
the towels?
Like ketchup in Australia.
Like
ketchup for your hamburger in Australia? Well, why do you want ketchup?
Oh my gosh.
All right, here's one packet, but don't ask us for another one.
Not only that, Bob, 30 cents for that packet.
Oh, yeah. Boy. Why would you want ketchup when you could have a beet on your hamburger?
It's cultural, I think, Steve. Just
yeah,
like
we're
Bob
spoiled Americans.
It's cultural. I mean, yeah. I mean, look, I'm not an overuser of towels. I really am not, you know, even at home or whatever. Like, I'm very, you know, I'll let my towels dry and I'll reuse them in a hotel. My bed sheets, I don't get washed all the time. But, you know, I mean, I'm on a boat with a pool. I need another towel. One round of towels is not going to cut it. And I'm not going to reuse a towel that has, you know, pool water soaked up in it. So whatever.
Just don't shower, bathe in the pool. You're good.
But then there was your typical dose of pseudoscience on the ship as well. And of course, it was in the spa and they had the whole gambit. They had everything. They had all the crap that you don't want to see that's there. You know,
the reflexology and the.
Yep. And
well, that's what spas are. spas are just basically medical pseudoscience.
Yep. Yeah. Anything that they can get an extra buck out of you. They had a, you know, a ton of acupuncture. They were like showing acupuncture videos all over the ship. And every time I'm just like, God damn it. You know, like, you know, I'm on vacation. Yeah. I don't want pseudoscience in my face, please. You know,
did they have the jade egg insertion booth?
I don't think they did. I didn't really do a super deep dive. I went into the spa. I was going to like start the discussion. And then I said, you know what? I'm on vacation.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, I don't want to do this right now. I don't want to get like all of my hackles up, you know. So I wasn't thrilled about the cruise line. But overall, though, it was really cool being out in the middle of the Atlantic, and it was scary. I mean, you really take a look at the ocean. I had plenty of time to stare out into the infinite, you know, this 15-mile radius. Yeah. And the scariest part of the entire trip for me was when...
Was it the Bermuda Triangle?
Right. That's going to be my question.
No, I've been to Bermuda twice, and there is nothing scary about the Bermuda Triangle. You know, I heard some people talking about it, but it wasn't really that big of a thing. They didn't even really have that. I think there was one tour on the
island. Too old school.
Yeah. Just people don't seem to care about it. Bermuda wasn't pushing it to make money out of all of the touristy stuff that gets jammed in your face. Oh, that's the other thing. I got to tell everyone real quick. One way to save a huge amount of money is do not buy the day packages from the boat.
Really?
You should plan those ahead of time before you go on the cruise directly with the people that offer them, right? Because all the boat is doing is marking it up.
Were there any rough nights at sea?
It was a little weather. Yeah, I mean,
pitch,
we had
little.
Yeah, there was a couple of 12-hour periods where the seas were rougher. I didn't have any problem. My wife gets motion sickness, and she took Dramamine, and she didn't really have any horrible problems. She got a little bit woozy, but it wasn't horrible. Overall, she felt like she did very good on the whole cruise, so overall it was fine. But yeah, you know, a little bit more wind and 3 or 4 feet more of waves in the boat, it would have been dramatically different. And I was talking to people that work on the boat, and they're being very careful about what they say to guests. But I had someone tell me, yeah, it gets rough out here. You know, it can get pretty, pretty dicey. The scariest thing I forgot to tell you, I was talking about it before. So you go to the very back of the boat, you know, you could see the engines, the push of the engines in the water. You could see the churned up water. And it was really scary to be in the back of the boat. You know, one is, you know, you're getting a good sense of motion because you could see water moving away from the boat. It's kind of surreal. You really can't tell how fast you're moving. These boats don't move that fast. They're only going about 22 knots or 25 miles an hour. They don't go fast. It's just that they're traveling, you know, for 3 days or two and a half days to get you to a spot, or 3 days to get you somewhere, versus, you know, an airplane. Yeah. Airplane ride to Bermuda is hour and 45 minutes, 2 hours from New York. And you're traveling for 2.5 days on a boat to get there. So yeah, okay, 25 miles an hour, that'll get you there. So it was funny because my guess was that, oh, maybe we're going about 50 miles an hour. No, not even.
No way.
You know, they don't go that fast. But, you know, the ships are gigantic. You know, you feel safe on the ship. You are surrounded by the luxuries of humanity when you're on one of these cruises. And, you know, you don't really get a sense that you're at sea unless you're out looking out the back or the front of the boat. Then you're like, yeah, man, we're nowhere. We are by ourselves. You are a speck of dust on a gigantic blue cloth. That's it.
And yeah.
If it weren't for modern technology, they would never find the boat. If it didn't have, you know, GPS and all that stuff, tons of ways to communicate.
Imagine 100 years ago, like crossing the Atlantic from Europe on a boat.
Yeah, nothing.
How about 400 years ago on like a sailing ship?
Yeah.
Trying to make your way across the ocean. Oh my goodness.
Not gonna do it.
Speaking of which, Jay, I had two more quick questions.
Good.
Any St. Elmo's fire? You see anything like that?
No, Evan, I was really hoping that I would see some weird anomalies or whatever.
Yeah.
I did not see anything. I didn't see one cool thing like that.
How about the stars at night, Jay?
You know what, Bob? The ship is light pollution in a way that you couldn't possibly imagine. This is the weird phenomenon that happens. So on a clear night at sea with no moon, you don't see anything. You look out, and because of the light pollution on the ship, you just see a black canvas with no line.
Wow.
My brain was creating a line where I thought the sea and sky met, but when Brian was like, look closer, do you really know where the sea ends and the sky begins? I'm like, nope. That was all in my mind. But even scarier, and this was by far, this was part of looking off the back of the ship and the scariest thing. So there was a pretty serious fog. Like I had about 30 feet of visibility off the back of the boat. And man, if you jumped off that ship, that boat would pull away from you and you are totally gone.
Yeah. Like, can't swim 25 miles an hour. That's for damn sure.
No, but even if they stopped the boat and they sent out a smaller boat to come find you, I mean, in that fog.
Called a dinghy.
Forget it. Forget it. The fog is like the fog on the sea. Like, you're a ghost. You don't exist anymore. Once you lose sight of that ship and no one can see you waving your arms, I bet you they have very hard time finding people. I mean, it's amazing to think that in a fog like that at sea, like, there's no way that when a fog is literally all the way down to sea level, there's no way visibly to see anything. You might as well not exist. That's how scary that is. Like, how are they going to find a single person out to sea? Like, you're gone. That's it. You don't want to fall.
You may as well have fallen off the edge of the earth.
Yeah.
Of the flat earth, right?
But it was very romantic, and they do have great food, and they do have great shows. Most cruise lines have both of those boxes checked.
Did you do the Titanic thing at the front of the boat?
Nah, there really wasn't a place to do it, and I wouldn't have done it anyway. I'm one of the few people that didn't enjoy that movie. That movie just bothered me. There was a lot of things about it I didn't like. I know everybody else loved it. I just didn't. I didn't think much of it. I thought it was really hokey.
It didn't float your boat?
No. I mean, to me, that whole thing was about the special effects that Cameron did about the boat sinking. That was the whole reason to go see that
movie. That was
pretty
cool.
It was pretty cool. But it didn't age well. If you go back and look at it today, the people look really wooden. The fake people look fake.
That's 25 years old.
That's right.
That movie now, yeah. And of course, you didn't see the Meg out there, right? Nothing like that.
No, nothing.
No whales.
No whales. No nothing. Not any, you know, the Atlantic Ocean is a very lonely place, man.
No Krakens.
Nope. There was no, unless the Kraken gave us a pass. I didn't see or hear anything weird. There was nothing.
No,
like,
UFOs.
No, nothing otherworldly spooky other than the vastness of the whole experience. And man, it is incredible when you finally see land again. Like, you pull up and it just felt like, oh. You know, you just realize, like, I'm a creature that lives on the land, and having land in view is very, very – it feels great. Getting off the boat –
You'd make a terrible pirate, Jay.
Oh, I would. Hurr, a pirate.
Yarr.
There was nothing fun about being on a pirate ship, I'll tell you that. Like, I'm in the lap of luxury, tons of food, more food than you could possibly deal with, all the towels you could steal, and
– Yeah.
And, you know, I was getting bored of being pampered. I wanted to be on the island. I'd much prefer to be on the island than be on the floating hotel. That's my final comment about the whole thing.
All right.
They know it would be fun if they did, like, a period murder mystery on the ship where, like, the whole time you're on the ship, there is some live-action role-playing event happening.
That Don't think cool. I didn't think about that and talk with my friends about that. There should have been – you know, things that hotels are starting to do now, and Star Wars Land at Disney World is going to have something like this, where your character has some type of meaning in what's going on in, like, a 2 or 3 day type of story that's going to happen. I mean, if they were cool about it, they could actually do something where you have to go around the ship to collect clues and interface with people. Like, you know, it would take
solve puzzles.
Yeah, it would take some doing, but man, that would be really entertaining.
Well, let's go on to some news items.
Hiya.
And the first news item is actually about UFOs, Jay.
All right, cool.
Recently, the Navy, the U.S. Navy, drafted new policies for how pilots and other personnel should report encounters with what they call unexplained aerial phenomena, or everyone else would call UFOs, or unidentified flying objects. And this, they say, was prompted by a lot of pilots claiming that they're seeing having an increased incidence of spotting these UFOs, and they feel like there's a stigma attached to reporting it. And so that pressure has led the Navy to draft up new policies to make it easier for pilots to report them anonymously.
I don't think that's a bad idea.
Yeah, I think it's actually a good idea.
Yeah, you don't have to, like, when you say UFO, you don't have to be like, oh, I think it's aliens. I mean, it could be – it's really, like, taken literally. I don't know what I saw. I need to report it. You got to – you know, you do with it what you want. I think that's fine.
And that's why they prefer the term unexplained aerial phenomena.
Right. They're just trying to get away from the term UFO has so much baggage. They're trying to get away from it.
Yeah.
But even still, that in and of itself hasn't helped. But I agree with you, Jay. I think that the real issue here, obviously, we don't think that there's any evidence that aliens are visiting the Earth. We have not seen anything compelling. And, you know, the more time goes by without there emerging any kind of definitive evidence, the more it seems like this is just a cultural phenomenon, what I call a psychocultural phenomenon. And many skeptics have pointed out that as cell phones have become ubiquitous. Like, everyone's walking around with a pretty good quality camera in their pocket all the time. That's resulted in an increase in videos and pictures of all kinds of interesting real things, but no increase in compelling photos or videos of UFOs. There's a lot of fake videos and fake pictures. You can get an app. You can get an app that will put a fake UFO in the background of your picture. But yeah, if Bigfoot or UFOs or whatever, if flying saucers were actually buzzing the earth, you would think that the fact that cameras increased by 1,000,000%, that would increase, you know, lucky pictures by a certain amount. So in any case,
the fact is with the idea that there are millions, billions of cell phones walking around with people that would love to take pictures of weird things like this. We're not seeing any real evidence.
Right. And think about all the weird crap you've seen on YouTube because people just happen to have a phone at the right place at the right time.
Sure.
All right. But I think that the real issue here is that there should not be a stigma attached to reporting UFOs or unexplained aerial phenomena. And in fact, that automatic association between UFO and flying saucer is the problem. And it amounts to an unwarranted assumption. The idea that because something is unknown, we have to think of aliens. And I liken this to astronomy, right? So every time astronomers find some new phenomenon that hasn't been encountered before, someone thinks that it's an alien phenomenon, right?
Yeah, fast radio burst.
Yeah, going all the way back to pulsars. You know, they were called LGMs for little green men.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yep. And then you remember Tabby's star. Right, the star that was having these dips in light.
Dyson sphere.
Alien megastructures. And then the most recent one is the interstellar asteroid Oumuamua. Right, remember that one?
Yeah, sure.
And an astronomer's like, hey, that could be an alien artifact, buzzing the Earth. What are the odds that it got so close to the Earth? Maybe they're looking at us. Well, never turns out to be the case.
Why was it changing velocity? But I assume it's a natural phenomenon.
Right. Every single time, at least so far, it's turned out to be a natural phenomenon. That doesn't mean that one day it won't turn out to be that. But it's not just because it's a new phenomenon or it's unknown doesn't mean that an alien phenomenon is likely, let alone that it's the cause. But that assumption does attach a bit of a popular stigma to reporting, and this has been inhibiting Navy pilots from reporting things that they witness that they can't explain. Now, of course, there are some serious things that could be going on. For example, this could be activity by hostile foreign governments, right? They could be spying on us or testing new aircraft or testing our defenses or whatever. There's lots of things that they could be doing that this might be a clue to, and so it shouldn't be in any way inhibited because, you know, people equate it with aliens. Or it could represent some truly unknown phenomenon that, you know, that we should be studying. It could be a natural phenomenon. Or let's say it's just all self-deception. It's optical illusions or whatever. Understanding how human pilots can be fooled by optical illusions, I think that's a pretty important thing to understand as well. So even if we don't think it's likely that any of these sightings relate to alien activity, whatever it is likely to be useful to study, whether it's psychological, neurological, a hostile foreign government, an unknown natural phenomenon, or just maybe it's something that we're doing. Maybe it's our own technology. One pattern that has been pretty clear over the last 50 years. So as cameras have become more popular, high quality pictures and videos of spacecraft have not increased. But as we've been putting more stuff up into the sky, that tracks really well with increased UFO sightings. People are mostly seeing our own stuff up there.
Garbage, most of it.
But satellites. Steve, are you talking about, like when you see a satellite mostly looks like a star that's moving very fast.
That's right. But it could be boosters reentering, as you say, space garbage reentering the atmosphere. Some satellites do flashlights and do things that make it look like something other than a star. And we don't have perspective. You look up at the sky, you have no perspective of size, distance, and therefore speed. And it completely fools our brain. Our brain just doesn't know how to make assumptions about those variables. So it does the best job it could, but it just constructs a completely, you know, false optical illusion most of the time. And again, that's an important thing to understand, especially as it relates to pilots and cockpits. You know, it's, I think we need to know what illusions they would be susceptible to. So anyway, I do think that it's fine. I think the Navy and the Air Force, for that matter, and not just the U.S., but around the world, should be open to reporting unknown phenomena. They shouldn't automatically be associated with alien phenomena. That actually creates a stigma that inhibits useful reporting that might be important information into other terrestrial phenomena, right? Interesting. So let's move on. Jay, this is kind of a wonky new material science thing, though Kara would hate this piece, this news item. But I found it fascinating. Phosphorine nanoribbons. Tell us about those.
Ooh, Bobby like.
So there has been news about this material going back about 5 years. The material isn't new, but this paper that was published in Nature is in fact about the scientists who are developing a process that can reliably manufacture large quantities of this material in a with controllable properties. And that's important. We want the properties to be controllable and predictable. So we hear about new materials all the time, especially when we talk about battery technology. You know, there's always some new thing and new materials or new ways of doing something with a new material. And it never manifests. And it's typically because we can't scale up the manufacturing process, right? So they come up with this thing. Steve, in your blog, you were funny about it because you were saying, hey, we have this great new thing. It's gonna make every battery last 100 days. But we need, you know, platinum to do it. And
this
battery is going to cost, you know, $300,000 or something. You know, you can't scale that up. You know, they could do it in a lab and make it really small, but you can't pass that around to, you know, 5 billion, 10 billion people. So let's talk about this one, because there's something cool about this particular one, because the scientists are saying there's really nothing stopping them from scaling it up, meaning no big price problems, no big resource problems. This is really important.
So for manufacturing.
For manufacturing. So what exactly are phosphorine nanoribbons? So the scientists who wrote the paper described them as, and this is great, Tayetel-like ribbons, one single atom thick and only 100 or so atoms across, but up to 100,000 atoms long. And in case you don't know what Tayetel is.
Tayetel.
I heard a guy pronounce it in Italian, and it's like, Tagliatella. You like that?
It's not Taglia. It's Talia.
Talia.
Yeah. GL is like LY. Tagliatella.
So it's a pasta that's shaped like fettuccine, but it's a little wider and less thick. And I wonder if the nano ribbons would taste good with nano meatballs.
Sure.
You think so?
Nice. Yes. Maybe with buckyballs.
Yeah, right. Bucky meatballs. So the ribbons are made of phosphorus, and this is an abundant element in the Earth's crust, and it's required by every cell in the human body to have normal function, by the way. There's a lot of phosphorus out there. The ribbons are exceptionally flexible. This is really cool. So they have no loss to their overall structural integrity, which is huge. It's a really, really big problem if you have it with the material that you're wanting to make. This one has no problem with that at all. It's probably more important that they're also very scalable, like I said. So scientists can make them different shapes, sizes, widths, thicknesses. This material is very, very malleable that way. It's important because this material can serve as a way to join different materials that have different dimensions, right? So let's say that you have in your cell phone, as an example, they have to squeeze a battery in over here, and they're trying to get the battery to connect to like the motherboard type of thing that's inside the cell phone. And the engineers are having a hard time fashioning a battery shaped this weird kind of way that hooks into an oddly shaped motherboard. And a lot of times you could lose energy because of the friction that occurs with a weird interface between two different materials, right? This could get rid of that problem. They can make a joint between two different materials, and the flow of electrons won't be slowed down at all with a material as malleable and shapeable as this material is. So that's a really big plus for it. And now here's something that you don't hear often. The researchers are saying that it may take as many as up to 20 years to develop this material. They're not pretending that it's 5 years away. They're not saying even, 10 years away. They're saying, we think we need a good 20 years to get it to the point where we've really mastered this material and we can really start using it and rolling it out. But the good news is that there's no known issues, like I said before, with scaling up the manufacturing of this material. And this is a very important point if you think about it, because most other advancements that we hear about, like I said before, they die on the vine. That's it. They come and they go and nothing happens to them. And there's nothing stopping the researchers now from saying, hey, let's dump more money and time into this, because there really isn't any of these weird things that come up with other – that we see so often in other material sciences that people are doing even today. So once we do start using this commercially, the material would be able to do a few cool things that they were willing to say this early on. They're saying that you could charge batteries 1,000 times faster than we can today. It could also increase battery capacity. And they're like, bingo, this could give us a 50% increase. This is not the typical, 1% increase that we're used to. Or, what is it, Steve? What do we typically see 1% increase a year in battery storage?
The average annual increase in capacity is 6%.
So, an increase of 50% is huge. It would be fantastic.
Yeah, but that's 20 years from now.
Yeah.
So it gets frustrating when you hear, oh, this is fantastic, but it's going to take 20, 25, 30 years, whatever, before this is actually in commercial products. But when you think about it, the crap we were reading about 20 years ago is now coming into use commercially, right? And so collectively, cumulatively, that's basically what we're seeing. So these kind of innovations are necessary to keep that process going forward.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah. All right. So let me reiterate what you just said, the way it works in my mind. You're saying that 20 years ago, somebody said, we'll make a 20, 50% increase in battery storage. And by the time the 20 years went by, now that that technology came here, when you map it back. Yeah. All right. So yeah, we need a constant flow of innovation like this to keep that 1%. That's where the 1% gains are coming from.
Yes. Okay. Right. Exactly. Right. So we are benefiting from it. We're just, we're benefiting from the stuff we were reading about 10, 20 years ago. And the stuff that we're reading about now, we don't know exactly which ones are going to pan out, but there's enough of it going on that I'm sure 20 years from now, 30 years from now, our batteries are going to be awesome compared to the ones today.
Now, what could be done though? Now, first off, this is a lab. They're being funded by somebody or, some company or some type of effort, but governments could actually back some of these better technologies that seem to have a better turnout. It might not take 20 years. If you throw enough minds and intel and money at an issue, maybe they can cut that time in half, which would be significant.
Yeah, this is, I think, where investment in the industry has an effect. It could speed up, this pace of research, pace of acceleration, and I think that's an important thing for us to be doing. This is something that I follow very, very closely. Improved battery technology is going to be critical for making our, remaking our energy infrastructure into more renewable sources. If we had cheap, abundant grid storage, and batteries can certainly fill that need if they were cost effective enough, that could make renewables increase the percentage of the energy that we can get from renewables, level off production and demand. It'd have an incredible beneficial effect on the grid. But just the batteries that are commercially available today, they're a bit expensive. They don't have the lifespan that we'd like to see. If we tried to put one in every house, we'd run out of raw materials, or the raw materials would get expensive very quickly. We need something that we could, we need the kind of technology where we could mass produce batteries that we can affordably put one in every building, a bank of them. As necessary, like to have that kind of distributed grid storage. And again, if we want our entire car fleet to be electric and have batteries, it has to fit that bill as well too. They don't have to be the same ones. The ones that we put in houses and the ones that we put in cars. But we need options for all of those uses, for grid storage, personal storage, and car storage.
Well, it's also good too to use a material like this. It doesn't seem to be bad for the environment. I don't know exactly what they're doing to the nano ribbons, but it seemed to be something that we really don't have to worry about. It may be even easily recycled. These are issues that are going to play out. If we upscaled our current battery technology, batteries are not that good for the environment.
That's true. They're hard to deal with. And it's a huge limiting factor. A lot of the benefits of renewable energy starts to get reversed by the rare earths that we have to use in the electronic equipment and the batteries and their short lifespan and what do we do when they're done. It's hard to get reclaim the material from them. So yeah, more environmentally friendly batteries would also have a huge advantage. But I do think that, and this is, you know, what studies are increasingly showing, that money that we invest in this kind of technology that could eventually be used to mitigate climate change and to also be sort of the energy infrastructure of the future, we'll get that money back many times over.
Yeah.
It's a good investment. It's not spending money. That's investing money that will save us and earn us a lot of money collectively in the future. Speeding up the pace of battery advance is absolutely a worthwhile infrastructure investment for the Earth, you know, let alone any one country. I think we definitely need to be doing it. It's still advancing nicely, but it would be, imagine if we could double the pace of battery advancement.
So, yes. Baby.
Bob, calm down there.
Billions of dollars.
It's a hugely important industry, hugely important
industry.
Oh, God. All right, let's move on. Bob, you're going to tell us about another electronic technology. Whoa. I've never heard of before. Hearables? What are hearables?
Yeah, right?
Is that like edibles? Only enough. You shove them in your ear?
A scientist is claiming that we are potentially about 5 years away from a new hearing aid technology she calls hearables that can monitor certain biological signals and actually help us deal with stress, concentration, and hearing issues in an audibly confusing environment and potentially much, much more than even that. The scientist's name is Poppy Crum, which is an awesome name cool. if I ever heard one. She is a neuroscientist and technologist and chief scientist at Dolby Laboratories and an adjunct professor at Stanford University. So she's not messing around. She recently published an article in IEEE Spectrum, which is the journal for the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. So what exactly is she proposing? And ears? Why? How can you do this with ears? Crum says, she has some interesting quotes here about this. The ear is this incredible hub of insight between our internal state and the external world. She continues, the ear is like a biological equivalent of a USB port. It is unparalleled not only as a point for writing to the brain, as happens when our earbuds transmit the sounds of our favorite music, but also for reading from the brain. And that was the really interesting part.
How's that?
I'll tell you, Jay, this is true. And far more than I realized, the more I thought about it and read about it, I was like, yeah, it really is a really fantastic place for a device that can be truly helpful and revolutionary in a lot of ways. So the skin in and around your ears is unique. In many ways, of course, everything we hear goes in there, obviously. But the blood vessels and the nerves that run close to the surface are there, you know, relatively easy to tap into, and they can actually provide a wealth of information about our internal state. So now we have things that are similar to this. If you go on to Amazon or a lot of websites, you'll see they've got rings and watches and patches that can simplistically do things like track physical stress and emotional stress by measuring galvanic skin response, right? How much you're sweating. And this is similar. So this is a similar idea, kind of, but it's on steroids, lots of steroids. Because not only are you placing it in a much better location on the body than, say, the wrist or the temple, but it's taking advantage. The idea is to take advantage of the latest machine learning algorithms and sensor technology. So, for example, just to show you one of the major ideas, I think, about these hearables, Crum claims that miniature electrodes on the hearables should be able to sense the weak electric fields around the brain. And then future hearables should be able to translate these fluctuations in these fields, in the frequencies, into electroencephalograms, EEGs. And now, so after decades of research, I mean, we know EEGs. We are very familiar with them. That knowledge can allow us now to correlate these EEGs with various states of mind, like stress, relaxation, anxiety, things like that. So you've got that. And then the idea is that you map. So now you have this map of the user's internal state to a certain extent, and then you associate that with the environment that the user is actually in. And this can be gleaned from the microphones that are also embedded onto the hearables. And then from there, you take, you know, specific important sounds that are in the environment that are deemed to be important. You could amplify them. You could minimize other sounds that are causing stress with the end goal for a lot of this to reduce stress and anxiety. So, Steve, I'll be curious to get some of your input on this, but some of this seems to be based on pretty solid research that we've known for years. It doesn't seem to be anything that's like, whoa, you know, that's, you know, that's a little, you know, pie in the sky or not reasonable. A lot of this seems very reasonable to me. So let me give you some examples, guys. Crumb lays out some scenarios of what we could do with this. So scenario one involves classic divided attention. So Steve, say you're watching What We Do in the Shadows on TV, and you're also cooking in the kitchen, but it's hard to follow the action, and your hearables determines that you're stressed because of what's happening to your blood pressure and to your brainwaves. So it's monitoring of that, and it's like, all right, Steve is stressed. And then Poppy describes what happens next as this. She says they can figure out exactly where you're trying to direct your attention by pairing that stress increase with variations in the electrical signals created in your ear as you move your eyes. Okay. Now, so to deal with this, the hearables will then automatically raise the volume of the sounds coming from the area of the house, which is stressing you, and hopefully making you more relaxed and less stressed. So it can determine by the movement of your eyes and the electrical signals that are created by that process. It can look at that information and say, all right, you're focused on this one area and it's causing you some stress. So it can actually increase the volume coming from that, you know, from where the TV is. And if there was a sound, if there was these other sounds behind you that you weren't paying attention to, it could potentially decrease that. So that's one scenario, and it's a pretty simplistic one actually as well. Scenario two, she describes Jay.
Yes.
She doesn't use your name, but I am. Jay, you're driving for hours with your kids and they're noisy and rambunctious. Can you relate to this?
Every day.
Yes. Okay. I figured you could. And you can't hear your navigator on your phone. And
that's right.
And then Olivia, Olivia says, potty time, daddy. So that's the scenario. So now your hearable knows that your kids are getting noisier because it's been tracking the environment and knows that, boy, they're getting noisier and noisier. And then they correlate that with your stress levels that are rising. Okay. And it kind of correlates those two. What the hearables can then do is automatically raise the volume of your phone based on previous biometrics, as well, change the airflow of the car to make it more comfortable for your kids. Let's see. The hearables could also look for the nearest bathroom for Olivia, and a bathroom that has food because Dylan also said that he wants some snacks. So that's the kind of thing that she's envisioning for these devices. It could read your internal state. It could read your environment and then actually make changes to your environment to reduce your stress and achieve some of these simple goals here. So let's see. Final scenario, Evan. So at this point, you've worn your hearables on and off for say a few years now, and your devices are collecting data. For all this time, they've detected specific changes in your patterns of speech and their spectral quality. So then after tracking this for a few months, they might suggest to you that you make a doctor's appointment because those changes are consistent with the possibility of heart disease or maybe even erectile dysfunction, but probably the former. So that last one was a little bit of a joke, but these are some of the claims that she's making there.
Actually, in my case, it's a big joke.
Right? So now what Crumb says is that this technology is basically here right now. It's here, and if it's not quite here, it's in the lab. It's in a laboratory setting. It's mostly there. So this is really she's not reaching really for any of those scenarios that I just described. And now if you do want to get a little bit more extreme with some of the possibilities here, there are things where they could they're talking about being able to diagnose diabetes through physiological changes that affect your vocal tract, and also changes of vocal patterns can also correlate with some different types of psychoses as well, apparently, that these hearables could potentially detect and notify you about. So that's what she lays out in her article. Of course, there's concerns, there's privacy and security concerns. I'm sure there's plenty of people that would never want to be under the constant scrutiny that these devices would subject you to. You wouldn't really necessarily notice the constant scrutiny, but some people are just like, you know, they don't want to be monitored that way all the time. And there's also the possibility of hacking. You know, if you're in a very important meeting, there certainly could be a concern that these devices could be hacked and people could be listening in. So there's other things that could happen. Oh, and there's another application that I found especially interesting. They could also incorporate something like nerve stimulation as part of these, the hearables repertoire. Doctors now, Steve, you can confirm this, doctors now can stimulate nerves electrically to treat things like epilepsy and depression. Testing apparently is happening now for a host of other types of mental and physical maladies like tinnitus. They have ideas where they could use nerve stimulation, I think of the vagus nerve, to increase neurotransmitters, which can help take advantage of the neuroplasticity of the brain, to in some ways actually rewire the brain to deal with things like the constant ringing in your ears and mitigate or potentially, you know, kind of even remove them to a large degree. That's what they're looking at. So this is kind of exciting. You know, I like to think I'm on top of new types of technology that have tons of promise, but I haven't encountered this idea, you know, this idea of essentially an AI hearing aid supercomputer in your ear. It seems very promising and not nearly as speculative as you may think. But I am
because
curious
wearable
about your
technology is already a thing.
Yes, wearables.
So we
wearables
have many examples.
Absolutely, wearables are becoming a thing for sure. But this specific application of wearables called hearables is interesting and new to me. Steve, what are your thoughts on some of the neurological aspects of this?
So I think that like the basic concept of using AI algorithms to enhance our ability to interpret that kind of information is certainly a reasonable one. I think the idea that any of those applications that she mentioned in 5 years is ridiculous.
Really?
You know, yeah. I mean, just the clinical complexity alone, it sounds like somebody who's like a technologist, but not a clinician, and they're totally naive about how complicated it is to develop specific clinical applications. So it reminds me of somebody 30 years ago describing why antioxidants are going to cure all of these neurodegenerative diseases. Everything is true in terms of the basic science. And they're like, yeah, in 5-10 years, we're going to cure Alzheimer's and ALS and Parkinson's disease. And none of it worked out. It was all bullshit. Here we are 30 years later. None of it worked out. I was just at a Grand Rounds where the researcher said that the lack of effectiveness of antioxidants is the greatest scientific disappointment in their career.
Wow.
Because we thought this was going to cure everything and it cured nothing.
Right.
And so a lot of the things that you were saying, Bob, sound superficially okay, but are incredibly naive. Using electrical stimulation as a clinical tool, yeah, theoretically great. I have big hopes for it in the long term, but it's proving to be incredibly difficult. First of all, the epilepsy, yes, that's deep brain stimulation. Don't confuse deep brain stimulation with superficial nerve stimulation. You know what I mean? The devices that actually work are either invasive or very complicated. And the ones that you just like wear on the outside of your head, even if they have like approval to be used as devices, the data on them is very weak. It's not very compelling. And we've been trying this for decades, Bob, trying to like treat the low-hanging fruit with like transcutaneous nerve stimulation. And the results are compatible with there being no effect. Let me just put it that way.
That sucks.
We haven't really even been able to prove an effect. So I think that this kind of approach has potential.
Right.
But I also think that probably none of the things that she speculates about are going to be the actual applications, and we'll find some useful applications in things that she didn't think about. Or maybe
Oh, sure.
They might be tangentially related to them. But
right.
I do think, you know, getting back just to the hearing aid idea, tinnitus is a tough nut to crack. Tinnitus is not anything simple.
And no, I was hoping that would
Be but Steve, I didn't mean to imply that. Tackle, that's why I you seem to be focusing on nerve stimulation, and that's why I left that to the very end, because that was the more speculative, more beyond, you know, beyond the 5 years. She was not implying that this is 5 years.
Yeah, yeah. I do think the hearing part is the more plausible end of that. But even there, it's very challenging. Like, we have pretty good hearing aid technology now. And we know, because we have family members who are deaf. I think some of us are actually losing our hearing. It's just genetic in our family. And like already I'm at the point where if there's any background noise, I have a hard time interpreting conversational speech. Background noise is extremely distracting and it's challenging. You know, anybody who works in audio production, right, Jay, knows how difficult it is to do really meaningful post-production, which is essentially what they're talking about, separating out different sounds.
Absolutely.
And yeah, and there are certain kinds of things like background echoes. You basically can't fix that. There's like things that we've been trying to fix for decades in basic audio processing that are extremely challenging to do. So I do wonder how AI will affect that. And I do think that they will find application. I think the description that we're hearing about, oh, it's going to be able to do this and do that, is just strikes me all as incredibly naive. It's going to be orders of magnitude, I think, more complex than that. That doesn't mean it won't be useful. I think that, but the application end is, I think, is going to prove very challenging.
Well, what about the angle of the, what I, one of the things I found most interesting was the idea of the, you know, using this for, you know, for EEGs and actually getting some useful information about someone's EEGs from this device in your ear, and from there kind of correlate stress and anxiety from that.
How is the ear device going to read your EEG? Right now, we need to stick leads all over your head to get EEG information. And it's limited in resolution because of the attenuation
So it's saying that the electrodes on the hearables will be able to sense the weak electric fields, around the brain. And then from there, it can infer your EEGs from those weak from the changing of from the fluctuations of the fields. It could infer what the EEGs are from that. So is that unreasonable, that step right there?
Yes, that's unreasonable.
Okay.
That we don't have that technology. That's there's a ton of assumptions in there. You know, that's like saying, and then a miracle happens. You know, that's like and just saying, we're going to infer usable EEG signals from the weak signals that you're detecting at one or both ears? No. That's not 5 years away. No.
But other than that, you feel really good about it, right?
Yeah, other than that,
that doesn't mean that the basic approach of, you know, having an AI gathering data about you and then using that in some clinically useful way isn't a good idea in general.
Yeah, well, that might as well be anything, though. I mean,
that's kind of where we are with it, though, in terms of like just really, really just broad brushstroke. Hey, that's like saying we're going to use electrical stimulation to affect brain function. That's about the level where we're at. It's like, okay, that sounds like a good idea.
All right, let's get right on that.
Yeah. I'll stick my finger in the socket. Let's do it now.
You know, anyway, I'm jaded because every time I hear stuff like this, it turns out not to be true.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, or if it does come true, it's like 20 years after it was hyped or 30 years after it was hyped. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy.
Even now, man may be unwittingly changing the world's climate through the waste products of his civilization. Due to our release through factories and automobiles every year of more than 6 billion tons of carbon dioxide, which helps air absorb heat from the sun, our atmosphere seems to be getting warmer. This is bad. Well, it's been calculated a few degrees rise in the Earth's temperature would melt the polar ice caps.
That's scary music, Jay.
It was like Hitler music in the background.
That was Morbius.
It was
the actor that played Morbius. This was really cool. Now, you first off, keep in mind this was from the 50s.
Yeah,
That's interesting. That's a good historical documentation of what scientists were thinking back then.
So many people got this correct. Most people that wrote in got it correct because it was, you know, if you typed in some of the text to what that guy was saying, that you could find it. But there was one that stood out that I wanted to talk about that was incorrect, but worthy of me mentioning. So James Gallagher wrote in, "Hey Jay, I think this week's noisy is Carl Sagan talking about climate change in 1990 at NCSU." So, you know, first off, James, that's funny. Like, I find Carl Sagan's voice incredibly recognizable, and huge fan. It's not even close. But that is not a man talking in the 1990s. It's clearly not someone from the 1990s talking
with that background music.
So let me play a little bit of one of my favorite things that was ever created by a human. I'll play a little bit of this. This is Carl Sagan.
From this distant vantage point, the Earth might not seem of any particular interest. But for us, it's different. Consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it...
I could play that forever. Mm. That was A Pale Blue Dot by Carl Sagan. Yeah, Carl had a unique way of talking. But he did not have the 1950s, early 60s affectation, which you hear in this.
That mid-Atlantic accent.
James, definitely listen to Carl Sagan's Pale Blue Dot speech if you haven't. It will not only familiarize you with the sound of his voice, but it'll also, if you haven't heard it before, it's one of the most profound things that I've ever heard in my life. And the story behind it is, you know, I guess it's as profound as his speech, if not more profound. So take a look at that. That was not Carl Sagan, but thank you for giving me a reason to listen to that talk again. I absolutely love the Pale Blue Dot. The winner for last week's Noisy is Rich Ragalado. And Rich said, this week's Noisy is a clip from an episode of the Bell Telephone Science series entitled The Unchained Goddess. This particular episode was a mix or live action and animation. It explained how weather works and featured concern over climate change. It was produced by Frank Capra and featured Frank Baxter. That's the person's voice that you're hearing. And Frank was known as Dr. Research, and you could think of him as an early version of Bill Nye. Another cool thing, Mel Blanc was also involved with that project, and an actor named Jay Novello. Ever heard of Jay Novello?
No way.
Really? Yeah.
I have.
Yeah, I've heard of him. I probably told you about him because back when Google first came out and everyone Googled their name, I Googled my name and this actor came up and I'm like, oh, I never heard of this guy. So I did some research on Jay Novello and he was an actor from the 50s. And it's pretty funny. You know, his name is very close to mine. Okay, I got a new Noisy sent in from a listener named Mark Kienzinski, K-I-E-N-Z-Y-N-S-K-I. Right? I can't say the guy's name, but thank you for writing this in. This is cool. Steve, Bob, and Evan, what the hell is this? That's
Get
noisy.
Some. Get some.
It's a playing card in the spoke of a bicycle wheel.
Again, this is why I love Who's That Noisy, because it's so many things to so many different people. So what is that noisy? Give me some details about what's happening there. And you could email me at WTN with your guesses, with your and your awesome noises that you heard this week, WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Hey, this is a good time to remind everybody about Nexus, July 11th to 14th in New York City. This is our yearly conference on science and skepticism. It's going to be a lot of great speakers, but we do want to highlight this week one panel. This is a bit of an unusual panel. It is, and it's a panel discussion, not a workshop or a lecture. It's on evolutionary biologist Nathan Lentz and developmental biologist and geneticist Yelena Bernitskaya and ethics philosophy professor Aaron Rabinowitz of Philosophers in Space. They're going to be talking about, get this, everyone, what does the next step in evolution mean? They're basically going to talk about the science of the X-Men. That should be a lot of fun.
Oh, boy.
Huh.
Yeah. Science and philosophy of X-Men biology.
Yeah. I'm trying to think about where they're going to go with that. Like, they're going to talk about probably, like, what could potentially generate the energy that they need to do to have the powers that they have, like how these powers would manifest. That's pretty cool. That you really do need an evolutionary biologist to dig their heels in on that one.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, it should be a lot of fun. Our registration is still open. And do we sell out the private show yet? We almost sell it. We sell it almost immediately every year.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we did, but just go and check on the website if you're interested. The private show is a lot of fun. We usually limit the seats to, 40 or 50 seats. It gets quite intimate, and we usually do something that's very off. It's off the beaten path for the show. We're not just regurgitating a normal show. We do other stuff. A lot of times when George is with us, people cry.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we always have fun at the private shows, and also because we co-run this conference. We are largely available and easy to get in front of if you guys want to chit chat with us. We also usually bring a lot of good swag with us if you're interested in buying a souvenir. And also, just please show your support and come to Nexus because it's a great conference and most of you have not been to it. So I encourage you to go out and get those tickets now.
All right, Evan, you're going to do a dumbest thing of the week. I just have to read the headline of this article. Mm-hmm. Oxford academic argues invisible aliens are interbreeding with humans.
Oh, yes, wow. That is an argument, and that is. But coming from an Oxford instructor. Well, maybe perhaps that's the unusual part of this. But in any case, it was brought to our attention by the Oxford Student, which is the student newspaper at Oxford University. And they brought our attention to a video from 7 years ago of Oxford instructor Dr. Yong-hae Chi. So Chi is an instructor in Korean at Oxford's Oriental Institute. And as evidenced by the video, he believes in a strong correlation between climate change and alien abductions.
What?
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
So this was in 2012, and Dr. Chi gave a lecture at the AMAC conference titled Alien Abduction and the Environmental Crisis, in which he outlined his theory concerning the presence of aliens on Earth. Now, just so you know, AMAC stands for Anomalous Mind Management Abductee Contactee Helpline. It's a support group for people who believe that they've been abducted by extraterrestrials. Mm-hmm. And it has, it in itself is a, you know, rather interesting group with some pretty amazing claims, including a woman who says that aliens fitted implants into her to monitor her, and a man who visits his alien wife and child several times a year. And one particular woman who's been abducted more than 1,000 times. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Now, when she says abducted, does she actually mean fall asleep?
Yeah, right. Right. What exactly is she talking about here? But this comes from, you know, this is data from their own website and, you know, their own newsletters and things that they have about their organization. Oh, there's another fella from there. I'll tell you about this before we move on to the doctor from Oxford. He specializes in being able to detect if you have been to another dimensional reality.
Wow.
Because he uses a UV mineral lamp that will reveal residue on your skin that can only indicate that you've been to another dimensional reality. Because
or that you recently had sex, I guess.
And you need a UV light. You need to know how to use the UV light correctly in order to make that determination. So this is the group. These are some just a few samples of the kind of group that Dr. Chi was addressing. And he began his lecture with the statement saying that perhaps human civilization is coming to an end. Ooh, provocative.
Wow, that's scary.
He cited a certain Dr. David Jacobs, who is an abduction researcher in the United States, who has argued that aliens' primary purpose is to colonize the Earth by interbreeding with humans to produce new hybrid species.
It's a hybrid,
of course.
Of which there are four, right?
Yep, that's right.
There are four types of aliens. Small, tall and bold, aliens with scales and with snake eyes, and finally, insect-like aliens.
Uh-huh. Which ones are trying to breed with humans?
Oh, I think they all are. Mm-hmm. But there's a hierarchy among these four types of aliens. He rolls right into it with the assumption alien abductions are real. They are not questioned. It is happening. And now we're going to my philosophy about why I think that they're here to, they're giving us insight as to the climate change dilemma that we're having on Earth, and in a way are trying to help us through the interbreeding in getting our hands around the problem by procreating with people and intermixing these species.
And the evidence for this is
evidence. Let's see. Evidence. None. So
get right back to us.
Obvious winner of dumbest thing of the week, but you really do have to wonder how it is they've gotten to this point where they can actually evade any sort of critical analysis of the things that they are saying, and why they haven't been, in a way, challenged by their peers even. I mean, in this case, this is an instructor at Oxford. You know, he's been talking about this thing for many years while being there with no apparent blowback, feedback, criticism, discipline, or anything else. He's just allowed to sort of go his merry way and spread his own belief system in this fashion, and all under the banner of Oxford.
Interesting. And he's not like a tenured professor or anything. He's just an instructor.
No, he's not a tenured professor. No, he's not.
Yep. All right. Thanks, Evan. So we have a great interview coming up with the director of the movie Behind the Curve about the flat Earth movement. So let's go to that interview now. We'll be right back. Joining us now is Daniel Clark. Daniel, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And Daniel, we are having you on the show because you are the director of an interesting recent movie called Behind the Curve, which was released, I guess, in November 2018 was the official release. And then Evan and I watched it recently. Yeah, really interesting. I mean, obviously, we're very familiar with the Flat Earth movement. And yet still, I felt I learned a lot by watching that movie. What got you interested in doing a documentary on this phenomenon?
I think, like a lot of people, you know, I saw it on the internet and, you know, my producer Nick saw it on Reddit, and we kind of thought it was either really small or some kind of troll. But as time went on, we realized it was real. And looking into it for about a couple minutes, you realize that this is a really interesting topic. And as documentary filmmakers, we said, let's see if there's some sort of movie to be made about this. And we looked into it, and there definitely was. So it didn't take much looking to realize that. Yeah, it was worth telling the story and explaining who these people actually are.
Yeah, I think that's the same reaction that most people have, is they don't really believe that. These people, they're right. Pulling your leg. It's like, no, they really believe it. This is not just all a joke. But so have you done topics like this before, people who either believe something far outside the mainstream or are science deniers, or is this really your first foray into this area?
This is my first. Caroline Clark, who also produced the film, she has done a short film about Sandy Hook deniers.
Yeah.
So this is a much less, I think, painful version of that same mentality. And so she has experience doing it. But I just, you know, I've known conspiracy theorists through my life, and I've always been interested in psychology and science. So while this is my first film about this, this is definitely the culmination of a lot of my interests.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about Mark Sargent. So he ended up being the star, if you will, of this show. Like, when you started filming, did you know we're going to focus on this guy, or did that just turn out that that's where the film led?
Well, when you're making documentaries, you know, there's always people who just are easily accessible, and they stand out on camera, and they're willing to talk to you and let you into their lives. And Mark was definitely all those things. So he was the first person we contacted and interviewed in the Flat Earth. And as soon as we met him, and as soon as we came back with the footage, it was like, this guy is a great documentary subject because he's willing to be himself on camera. There's no shyness about him, and he's all out there. And so it's really nice when you have that opportunity as a documentary filmmaker that someone's willing to let you in and to be themselves on camera. And they're also a really interesting person to follow.
Yeah, so what was your take on Mark Sargent? Because, you know, he's obviously he doesn't come out flattering in the movie. You know, he, as you say, he's not shy. That kind of is his thing. He seems like somebody who is mainly out for the notoriety. Was that your take?
A lot of people have said this about him, and it's interesting because I think on one hand, yes, but I don't think it's unique to him. I think he started in earnest just wanting to do it, and he's a very logical guy. So I think the Flat Earth clues were him more or less organizing his thoughts and making it into a video. It was just like the way he was doing that. You know, who wouldn't like to be, you know, invited and flown out to conferences all over the place? I mean, that's happening somewhat to me because of the film, and I enjoy it, but I'm not doing it because of that, you know. So I wouldn't say that Mark started for the fame, but I will say that the fame is probably keeping him very close to the community. And if he ever had doubts, if he ever has doubts about it, I think it'll be really hard for him to accept them in the face of losing what he has built.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I just think that the people in the community, I can't say all, obviously, but my sense is that they believe, they really are sincere in their belief. And then they get carried away with the celebrity, you know, within their own movement. But there is that does lead to that one key moment at the end of the film where you essentially ask Mark, so like, do you think you're the mayor of the Flat Earth town? Like, in other words, are you locked into this because of the celebrity that it brings you? And his reaction was, you know, was interesting. What did you make about that? And I'm sure there's more to it that didn't show up that didn't make it into the final cut, because it cuts away at that point. But what was your sense about how did he react to that?
You know, that's something we started noticing along the way. And after talking to one of our experts, Paris Pinstockness, who has, you know, done a lot of research into this, and saying that there's nothing to gain by losing something like this. And you know, how political pundits come to be. They have nothing to gain by losing that element of themselves. And so we were seeing Mark, you know, as this celebrity and this kind of leader of this movement that has allegedly no leader. And that question popped into my head and I was like, all right, well, I'll ask him about it. So, but in that moment, yeah, he said straight up, he referenced another person who had tried to leave, but the community grabbed them and brought them back in. And so, yeah, he just doesn't think he can leave, even if he wants to, which is a really interesting thing to say about a belief, you know?
Right, right. Well, I think it's hard for anybody in an insulated belief system, whether it's a cult, which I do think this is, you know, has some cult aspects to it, or whatnot, is it's you lose everything if you leave the community. And it's not as if, you know, he's going to be popular outside of that community, you know?
Right. I mean, in Flat Earth, he is one of the biggest people. People know who he is just randomly on the street. And when he goes to a conference, he's the keynote speaker. Whereas before, he was a software developer and engineer, or software tester or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people didn't care. When he walked into a room, people were like, oh, you're here to do the job. So yeah, it's not surprising that he would want to hold on to that. And I don't think it's unique to him. I think it's a human thing.
Plus, sure. It makes sense that he would want to surround himself with a community, certainly, that feeds into his worldview as it is. And why would he leave that comfort zone? He really has no reason to.
It would take a lot.
It would take a lot. Yeah. But did he, at any point in your interaction with him, did he allow for any doubts?
If you say that he allows for doubts and questioning, and, you know, like there's at the beginning of the movie, we have him explaining how he came to be. And he said he put out the flat earth clues and he was expecting some scientist to say, you did the math wrong, you're wrong. But he said that never happened, when in fact that happens all the time. And people explain to him why he's wrong all the time. He just doesn't accept it. And so he says that he's open. I think it's just he never sets a criteria for what he's open to. Because, you know, it's easier to say, oh, well, this person said this, but, you know, they work for the government. Of course, they're going to say that. It's like, well, this person's an astrophysicist. Their career depends on their Earth being a globe. So, of course, they're going to say this. Like, so there's a lot of excuses. And I'm not, you know, I don't mean to, like, to be mean or anything about it. It's just, if you say you're open to something and then you close yourself off to everything that you said you were open to, I think then you're not an open person.
Yeah, I mean, it's always going to be a certain aspect of intellectual dishonesty in any kind of fringe belief like this, even though they might not recognize it as such. I think they tend to rely upon motivated reasoning and conspiracy theories in order to insulate themselves, which brings us to an aspect of the film that I think would probably be most fascinating to skeptics like us, is that this is like, we're fascinated with this idea. What happens when you take somebody who believes something that's obviously not true and they're confronted with, you know, pretty much definitive proof that their belief system is not true? It's always like this morbid fascination. How will they, although we know how they're going to react, but still it's like, it's hard to imagine. So there's a few moments like this in this film. I think the first one is with, is it Bob Nodell? Is that how you pronounce his name?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, so tell us about that. That's a really great story. So, you know, about his someone I think he knows invested $20,000 in this gyroscope. What happened with that?
Yes, and Bob has since talked to me, and he said it's actually more like $17,000. So,
all right.
Yeah, so someone he's like in a group that just people online, like almost like a small chat or some kind of organization. They do experiments and they contact each other and they ask for help and they talk about the results and things like that. And one of those people was really interested in doing a gyro experiment, where they would take a gyroscope and test the rotation of the Earth by seeing how much a gyro processes over the course of an hour. And since the Earth is spinning at 360 degrees per day, every hour it turns 15 degrees or processes 15 degrees. That's the premise of the hypothesis, that if the Earth is flat, then it shouldn't be turning, period. So they purchase this really expensive gyroscope that's very, very sensitive, and they test it, and it does pick up a 15 degree per hour drift. And I think it's a good scientific move to say, okay, maybe it's getting some sort of interference from the outside, so let's encase it in some sort of Faraday cage-like device. So they do that, but they still pick up the the drift, which they would on a rotating sphere.
Mm-hmm.
But then they say that that's not an acceptable answer, and it must be something else. Their explanation is it's the ether, which is something that has been disproven.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the only thing that would allow for that sort of information. Basically, he's saying that there is a electromagnetic energy coming from the display system above, which would be the stars to most people. So that's what's rotating, and that's what's picking up the drift on the gyroscope. And that's kind of their explanation. So they keep explaining farther and more complicated reasons why their experiment didn't work instead of accepting the result that they got as the answer.
Yeah, it's a form of special pleading in order for them to save face when the experiments don't go the way they need to reinforce their positions. And we see this not just in flat earthers, but pretty much anyone who has extraordinary claims of any kind. This is always, always, without exception, the end result is the special pleading that comes following the experiments.
Yeah, I liken it to, keep flipping the coin until it lands on heads, even though it hit tails a bunch of times. And that's something that just drives me a little nuts too, is a lot of these experiments that they do, they don't set out clear result, like they don't set out clear result findings. So it actually took a lot. There's an experiment at the end with Jaren where they do a laser test, and I had him explain to me several times on camera because he wasn't giving me a definitive answer. I said, if it's this, what is it? If it's this, what is it? Because you can't just say, we'll see what we find. Because then you have to say, you have to set criteria for what
you have to make a prediction. You can't just explain it in retrospect.
We've tested people for all sorts of paranormal challenges, and the hardest thing for them to do, it seems, is to explain exactly what it is they're either doing or trying to do. And that's what I sensed as well through these tests that they were talking about in the documentary.
Yeah, I like the idea, I like the word prediction. They were making predictions on what would happen. And if they got the negative result they weren't expecting in a flat earth model, then they should have taken that as evidence instead of trying to explain away. And I'm not saying they had to believe the earth was a sphere right away, but I think that they had to say, okay, there is a drift, so we have no evidence for a flat earth so far.
Right.
You know?
Or take that to its conclusion. I think in the film, Nodell says they're doing the next experiment where they're going to use some different material to encase it, but we never hear the results of that. I don't know if he had time to do that, before the film was done.
He still has not done that, to my knowledge.
I mean, I guess he can't find enough of that material or somebody to make the cage out of it. I forget, it was some kind of metal. Do you remember what kind of metal it was?
It was bismuth.
Bismuth,
believe is the heaviest metal that's not radioactive.
Yeah, so that will do it. but this is the difference between science and pseudoscience. Pseudoscientists know their conclusions and are working backwards, and a scientist has to make predictions that say this will support or refute my hypothesis, but they never quite close the loop on that. But that, as dramatic as that, those two experiments were the laser and the gyroscope, and at the end of the movie, they basically prove that the world is curved. And he's like, oh, interesting. But then you mentioned that, but it was bouncing off the reeds or whatever in just the right amount, as if the earth were a sphere. But I think the most dramatic moment, though, in the movie is when Patricia is sort of talking while she's driving about the conspiracies against her. Right.
Yes.
And she's basically she gets it. Like when she's the target of the conspiracy, it gives her a perspective that allows her to see how the conspiracy mongering works. And she sort of just flirts with this insight. It's like, you think I'm doing that? But how far did she go with that? It's like, yes, come on, you're almost there. Just go with it a little bit more. But she never quite. What was your sense about her? She seemed to have this flash of insight, but it never really went anywhere.
Yeah, that was a really incredible thing to see go through someone's mind, because I didn't prompt her at all with that. She was really just talking.
Yeah.
Because there was a guy at the party, because they had just done like a meetup in Houston. It didn't really make the film. Like a small part is in there, but it really didn't make the film. But she's driving back from that, and there was a guy there who was one of the people who says that she's transgender and all that stuff. And she was offended. She was hurt. You know, she's not because of the accusation, but just because that people believe she's who she says she is. And she was talking about it and kind of went through all those questions that she says in the film. And I didn't really press her on it. In hindsight, I maybe wish I would have, but I didn't at the time. But yeah, she got so close. She said, like, maybe I'm making the same jumps of logic that they are, but not, I'm not. Which is, nobody thinks that they're wrong, you know? It takes a lot to start questioning if you are correct in your own beliefs. Because when they're your beliefs, you know things. And if you started telling me that something I, quote-unquote, know is false, it's going to take a lot for you to convince me. And if I don't want to know it, or if I don't want to change my belief, I just won't. And the brain has ways of doing that. And it's not a conscious decision. It's more like, you know, your brain's defense mechanism.
And that's exactly what they're saying about us from the other side. It's the exact same thing they're saying.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah. And there is something to that. I mean, nobody's 100% right. Well, maybe not nobody, but most people are not 100% right.
Yeah, right. I mean, we're not suggesting there's an equivalency there because, you know, it's all about the method. Like, you know, science should use legitimate methods and should question that. A good scientist tries to prove themselves wrong. These guys aren't doing that. They're trying to prove themselves right. And it's interesting. It's good that's why we like to look at, you know, we being like skeptics in general, we like to look at these extreme belief systems because it is so revealing about the psychology of how people get themselves into these belief systems. Like, who would have thought, like, really, flat Earth? I mean, that's probably the most extreme belief system that we encounter, so the most counterfactual. And so
plus
easily,
creationism, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, the evolution, you could see that people can't imagine stuff happening over millions of years. I mean, the flat Earth makes the least sense, even from just a basic internal consistency point of view. You know, like, there's no way that holds water, even for a moment. None of these people struck me as being not intelligent, right? I mean, was that your sense? They all seemed to, like, they probably have enough raw intelligence to understand why the Earth can't be flat, and yet still they managed to find themselves trapped in this belief system.
Yeah, I'm sure it's you know, the community seemed like a cross section of any community. Maybe not if, like, you're talking about scientists at a convention, but, you know, if you go anywhere, you're going to see people who are really well educated and logical and people who aren't, and you see that in flat Earth, obviously. But there's no real, it's not because they're dumb. And so, in fact, a lot of this comes from people who are really smart and they're outsmarting themselves. You know, like, it takes a lot of brain power to think, well, it's not the Earth that's rotating, it's the sky. And it's actually, it comes down to this concept of the ether, that there's this moving fluid sort of in the universe. So yeah, like, that's not a simple thought. It's a lot of complication, concepts in there.
Yeah, yeah, I like that idea. They're basically, that's motivated reasoning. They're outsmarting themselves, as you say. And we see that as well, that actually there's a certain sort of sweet spot of people who are educated and intelligent enough to be cocky enough, you know, to be comfortable believing something outside the mainstream like this. But they don't have quite enough scientific, you know, training to pick apart their own position. But that's like most people, I think, are in that position. That's like, these are other than the flat Earth thing, you know, these are just everyday people, right? Was that your sense as well?
Yeah, definitely. And something you said is really sticking with me, which is like, yeah, and this, it's why we made the film about flat Earth and not, you know, climate change or vaccinations, is because flat Earth is something you can literally go outside and look at the sky, see it changing, and just everything about the evidence is, and it's so immediate, and there are so many tests you can do. Whereas evolution, you need to know a lot about biology. You can read books and things like that, but you can't just go outside and look at it and know for sure that it's real. So. Right. That's the thing about flat Earth, is that, you know, you have to deny kind of what you're seeing and just see it in a completely different way in order to believe it. Like, to look at the moon and think that it's a spotlight and not a sphere floating.
Right.
It's a big, big leap. That's why we decided to use flat Earth as more of an analogy to, you know, extreme beliefs of anything.
Yeah. I agree. And again, that's kind of the approach that we take, where these are like psychological field experiments. Like, why do people believe what they do? And but it applies to everybody because we all do this, right? We all do the motivated reasoning, just on a much smaller scale. It's like seeing, I like to liken it to seeing a disease in the advanced stage where you get to really see the fully formed features of it. And that helps you recognize it in the much more subtle early stages that we sort of all suffer from. But it's fascinating. Again, it's just like amazing to see, you know, how the mind works to create this phenomenon, how cocky they are, you know.
Oh, Daniel, the documentary does a really nice job, especially towards the end, of driving home the point. And you let them say it in their own words, that these are basically people who are otherwise isolated, feeling alone, feeling confined in some respect, and their community, they're able to draw or lean on each other for that support that they get because they can't find any other really community to be a part of.
We've also talked to a lot of people since then, and like psychologists and sociologists and people who just know about conspiracy groups and things like that. And it's the sense of it's a human quality that we want some sort of order to our chaotic world. Some people find comfort in science and understanding that there are these basic laws that govern everything that exists, and that find that really interesting. And some people go to religion, and some people go to conspiracy. Sometimes they intertwine and whatnot, but it's putting a sense of order to the universe rather than the chaos that, you know, in my head, I think the world is quite chaotic.
Yeah.
And there's really there's no order to it. I mean, there's something, but can't say for sure what.
All right, Daniel, well, thank you so much for joining us for this interview. It's really been interesting. And if anybody in our audience has not watched Behind the Curve yet, it's a must-see for any skeptic. Absolutely. It's just a fascinating look at this phenomenon.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Evan, for talking to me. And thank you for recommending the movie.
Yep.
No, thank you. Congratulations on a great project.
Yeah, take care.
So thank you very much, guys.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. All right, I'm coming off a mega sweep last week.
Oh,
guys,
a broom and everything.
Totally swept me. But this week I have three regular news items.
All right.
Are you ready for this?
Do it.
All right, item number one, a new comprehensive review finds that despite their dangers, porcupines make up a substantial portion of the normal diet of African lions. Item number two, for the first time, researchers have documented the ability to form transitive inference, applying learned rules to a unique situation in an invertebrate species, the paper wasp. And item number three, a new analysis finds that between 2010 and 2016, the use of services like Uber and Lyft were responsible for most of the increase in traffic congestion in San Francisco. Jay, go first.
A new comprehensive review that finds, despite their dangers, that porcupines make up a substantial portion of the normal diet of African lions. I'm not so sure about that. I don't know. Porcupines are a pain in the ass. Pretty much anywhere you touch them, actually. Yeah, I don't know. Let me go on. You know, just thinking it over. For the first time, researchers have documented the ability to form transitive inference, applying learned rules to a unique situation in an invertebrate species, the paper wasp. That's what they were studying, the paper wasp, Steve?
Yes.
Okay. So a wasp can apply transitive inference. I wouldn't be surprised about that. Last one, a new analysis finds that between 2010 and 2016, the use of services like Uber and Lyft were responsible for most of the increase in traffic congestion in San Francisco. They were responsible for most of the increase? Huh. Well, San Francisco's traffic is horrible. I've been there more than once, and it is horrible. That is a really cool news item, if that's true. Responsible for most of the increase. But, you know, the flip on this, if this is the fake, is that they could say that Uber and Lyft were significantly responsible for a lack of traffic, but I don't remember reading about that. You know, maybe more people are using Uber and Lyft and not taking public transportation. So I could see that being true. I don't think this one about the lions and the porcupines is true. I really don't. I don't see a lion going through the trouble of eating a porcupine. I would think a lion would want a larger animal to feed the pride. So I think that one's the fake.
Okay, Bob.
Okay, let's start from the bottom here. The Uber and Lyft one. It doesn't sound right. How could, I mean, how could it make what I can't I don't know how that could, you know, be the case. Doesn't, you know, feng shui for me. So let's go to two. Transitive inference, sure. I mean, I try never to be pessimistic about what non, you know, invertebrates can do cognitively, and sure. I mean, I can't think of any reason to discount that out of hand. But as Jay said, this porcupine lion thing is not making sense. First off, it seems like there's a lot of work for just a little bit of meat that these big cats are gonna spend the time that would be required. I remember seeing a documentary of some animal eating porcupines, but it wasn't a lion, and it was a little bit, you know, it was tough. I think if I'm remembering correctly, they actually just ate it. They had, for whatever reason, they had the digestive tract that it did not bother them, and they could just spit it back up or whatever, the quills. But I don't think lions could do that, and I don't think they would devote the time and effort required for just a meager amount of meat. I mean, so yeah, I'll say that one's fiction as well.
And Evan?
Yeah, reverse order as well. Uber and Lyft in San Francisco, although I'm not all that familiar with the history of transportation of San Francisco, they have been known for public transportation for quite some time, you know, the rail cars, right? The Rice-A-Roni commercials and stuff from the 70s. So public transportation has always been a big part, I believe, of San Francisco. So therefore, when you start adding in all these Uber cars, Lyft cars, then that would make sense that there's your traffic increase because of those. Whereas, you know, people were busing, training, streetcarring, and other things before. So the next one, the second one about the transitive inference of the paper wasp. So that means they're able to figure out kind of two things with an intermediary in between and relate the two on the ends, right? If you have three things, it's the one in the middle that links the two. They're able to go, therefore, from the first to the third. Am I thinking about that right? That's pretty advanced. However, insects can do some pretty amazing things. But the paper wasp, I just, you know, don't know much about it. I wouldn't be surprised, though. I am leaning with the guys about the porcupines and the lions. I think the only thing I could possibly think about here is that, obviously, the quill problem. But I don't know, do baby porcupines or young porcupines, maybe they're quills aren't as developed and those are easier to swallow up. But again, Jay brought up the point, you'd have to have probably a lot of porcupines at that point to feed your average lion. Not enough there to satiate them. Therefore, I'll agree with the guys that that's the fiction.
Okay, well, let's start with number two, since you guys seem to have the easiest time with that. For the first time, researchers have documented the ability to form transitive inference, applying learned rules to a unique situation, in an invertebrate species, the paper wasp. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science. This one is very cool. This is the first time. Now, this is a study that they did with honeybees previously, and honeybees failed this test.
They're so stupid.
Well, honeybees are actually pretty smart for little insects. How many neurons do you think
they have?
Yeah,
but they can't
engage
in transitive inference.
How many neurons?
Yeah.
50.
About a million.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, which is about the size of a grain of rice is their brain.
What?
But a million neurons. Now, the paper wasp has a more complicated social interaction than the honeybee. So researchers said, hey, maybe they can do this logical inference, transitive inference. And because, you know, their social interactions may give them this ability. And it turns out that they could. Now, the specific test that they did was they showed the wasps two different colors, two different colored paper. And I guess they had, you know, food or something on it that they wanted. But one would give them an electric shock and the other wouldn't. And they were two different colors. So the wasp could learn the rule about which colored paper carries the shock.
Oh, that's clever.
Then they would do it with a different pair of colored papers. And again, one would give them a shock and one wouldn't. And they would learn that rule. And there was sort of a meta rule that, you know, that you could, you know, if you could see, like, yeah, I don't know exactly what it was in the write-up that didn't say, but let's say, like, the darker one always has the shock. Then they show the wasp two unique colors. And they were able to extrapolate the rule from the ones they learned, they experienced, to the unique situation and figure out which one had the shock
and avoid it. That's a great study.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah.
Transitive inference. So first invertebrate species. This has been shown in many animal species, many mammal species. This is the first time it's been shown in species without a spine.
Well, time to start testing more species without spines.
Pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, pretty cool. But again, there was a reason to think that the paper wasp may have this because they have a complex hierarchy and more social interactions. They have to be able to do this transitive inference, even just in their social interactions. Okay, let's go back to number one. A new comprehensive review finds that despite their dangers, porcupines make up a substantial portion of the normal diet of African lions. You guys all think this one is the fiction. Let me ask you guys a question, though, because based upon your answers, I'm interested in how much you think porcupines weigh.
Oh, no, 10 pounds, 15 pounds.
Average adult porcupine.
15 pounds.
24.
I'll say 30 pounds.
So first of all, the correct answer is, what do you mean, African or European?
we're talking about lions here.
There are many species of porcupine. So let's talk about the African crested porcupine.
Okay, let's talk about them.
African porcupines, first of all, they're rodents. Did you know that they're rodents?
Nope.
No.
Adult African porcupines can weigh between 40 and 60 pounds.
All right. That's a big chunk of meat there.
They are a nice, juicy, substantial meal.
All right.
Sure.
I always thought it was smaller, more like hedgehog, Sonic the Hedgehog.
But prickly.
But prickly, right. So the question is the that much meat in an otherwise slow and easily killed animal worth risking the quills? Yeah. That's the question. So I will tell you.
I hate Quill, man. What he did with Thanos, man, totally pissed me off.
Seriously.
African lions do occasionally eat porcupines.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yes, but you said staple.
However.
But this one is the fiction.
Yeah.
Because it's not a substantial portion of their diet, nor is it normal. Mm. So it's usually an act of desperation.
Right, like eating a pine cone. I mean, nobody would really do that.
Yeah, so lions will eat porcupines because it's a lot of meat. You know, if you have a lone lion, you know, we'll sort of take out a porcupine for a meal. And they will do it deliberately sometimes, even risking the quills. However, it's a very, very high-risk endeavor. They're almost always injured in the process. So they only do it when their normal prey is not available because of drought, you know, season or loss of habitat or poaching or whatever. But here's the other thing. This is what the study actually showed. Well, a few things. One is that it's mostly young male lions who will kill the porcupines. Older lions know better, and the females who are actually the hunters in the pride know better. Mm. But the young males are too dumb to know not to eat them.
Inexperienced.
Or they're too inexperienced or impulsive or whatever. Lions frequently injure themselves when they eat a porcupine. And then when they do that, that may impair their ability to hunt their normal prey because they might injure their mouth or their face or their tongue or whatever. And because that will mean they can't go after zebras or giraffes, they start going after easier prey. And do you know what easier prey is for an African lion?
A small child.
Yeah.
People.
Yep.
Or livestock.
Wow.
Sure.
And they found that injuries from trying to eat porcupines is often a precursor to lions starting to hunt either people or livestock.
Oh.
But I guess also it could be that the same desperate situation that would make them go after a porcupine may also make them go after non-typical prey for them, people.
And so we can't have a porcupine gap is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Oh.
Right. All this means that a new analysis finds that between 2010 and 2016, the use of services like Uber and Lyft were responsible for most of the increase in traffic congestion in San Francisco is science.
Yeah.
This was a surprising finding, but that is what they found. Now, of course, some of the increase is due to population increase. There's just more cars in San Francisco than there was, you know, 2010, but they found that in their study that it they attributed 69% of the increase to Uber and Lyft.
Wow.
Between those years. Well, it's because people are using their services. It's not
instead of walking, instead of public transportation.
Yeah, right. So the idea, the hope was that people would be using it instead of their own car, and that people might even not bring a car into the city, you know, because they could rely upon Uber and Lyft. But the convenience of these services is that more people are using them, and these cars are driving around looking for fares as well. So it actually increased the congestion in the city, which is bad.
Yeah, that reminds me of autonomous driving. People are thinking, you know, the same thing could happen with that, that people will be spending a lot more time in the cars because you could do whatever you want. You could sleep, you could have sex, you could do, you know, it's not annoying anymore.
Yeah.
So they think that could increase congestion.
But there is research into eliminating or at least reducing so-called phantom congestion, where phantom traffic jams. You know how, like, where you ever get into a traffic jam where there's nothing, there's no accident, there's no holdup. It's just
human
the way people,
and chaos.
The way people are driving, they get bunched up, and networked, intelligent, self-driving cars could space themselves out and not cause these phantom traffic jams. Theoretically, we haven't cracked that nut yet, but I'm sure using AI we will. That is the kind of thing where I would think, in 5 years, that's something we could crack easily. So, I think certainly by the time we have a significant fleet. Then the question becomes, guys, what percentage of the fleet needs to be self-driving before it will significantly reduce these phantom traffic jams?
80%. Wow, I asked 75.
We don't know.
I thought it was more trivia.
Then I won't even guess.
We can only that's a question we haven't answered yet. This is something that we won't know. We can try to computer model it, and that's what we're doing now. But we won't know until they're actually on the street. You know, interesting. Yeah, I know. It's like we think, LED bulbs are going to save us electricity because they use less electricity. Then people just use more light. When things become easier and cheaper, we just fill the void. We just fill the gas. It's like when you get the bigger hard drive on your computer, you just fill it. It's, however big it is, you find stuff to put in there.
Or Jay, you have the Diet Coke at the buffet and you have 12, slices of ham. Right.
I could see Jay bellying up to that buffet like a buddy.
eating way past the fill line.
All right. Well, good job today, guys. I kind of thought that you would go that way. I was trying to figure out if I should make that one the science, but I thought it would be see if I could, I didn't anticipate that you guys thought porcupines were so small.
Oh, interesting.
They're huge. I'm like, it made total sense. They'll eat porcupines. They're fucking 50, 60 pounds of meat.
Yeah, I mean, every time I see a picture of them, I don't have a real reference. They look like the size of a skunk to me.
Yeah, but you're probably looking at, like an American or whatever European porcupine.
Okay.
Yeah, that's about what
I will do some research, Steve.
All right. Evan, give us a quote.
All right. This quote was suggested by listener Conrad Stevens from Ashford, Kent in the United Kingdom. Thank you, Conrad. Now, I'm going to let you know who said the quote first before actually saying the quote on this one, because it makes more sense that way. This quote originated from Alberto Brandolini, 2013. He's an Italian programmer, and this is known as the bullshit asymmetry principle, or Brandolini's law. The amount of energy needed to refute bullshit is an order of magnitude bigger than to produce it.
Yep.
Yes. Huh. If not more.
If not more.
If not more.
Absolutely.
That's clever. That's a neat way to put it, especially from the mind of a programmer.
Right. And Brandolini's law is a corollary to the Gish Gallop, because that's the whole idea behind the Gish Gallop, is that you throw out so much bullshit misconceptions that your opponent in a debate could never debunk them all. It takes 10 times as much time.
That's right.
To correct a fallacy than it does to produce one. So it could actually become a useful, although sleazy, debating tactic.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. It's hard to contend with. Yep, Gish Gallop. All right. Thanks, Evan. And thank you guys for joining me this week.
It's good to be back, Steve.
Thank you. On Terra Firma. Yep.
And next week, Kara should be back with us. Looking forward to it. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions. dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.